You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congressman Glenn Grothman joins the show for a look at his congressional priorities, his reaction to Wisconsin's primary elections, and his thoughts on voter ID.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
This week's primary saw big turnout for a spring election in Wisconsin and the first test of that new voter ID law.
Also in the news, a number of media organizations around the state are suing the State Department of Justice. Robert Menser joins us now for more on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So, obviously, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz won Wisconsin's primary vote earlier this week, but how did the different parts of the state end up voting?
Sure. Well, you can see it sort of in the county-by-county map. On the Democratic side, it is a vast swath of Bernie Sanders counties. Only Milwaukee County actually went to Clinton. So a decisive win for Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. The Republican side is a lot more mixed. There are a lot of the population centers went for Ted Cruz. That's Milwaukee and the suburbs, at Green Bay, Madison, Oshkosh, Eau Claire, Wausau all went in the Cruz column, some by a larger margin than others. And then the entire north and most of the west of the state did go to Trump. Of course, those are very much more, more sparsely populated counties, so it doesn't do as much good. But if you look in the map, you can see a very clear kind of geographical split in the Republican Party.
And looking at the state Supreme Court race, there Justice Rebecca Bradley defeated Joanne Kloppenburg. How did that end up breaking down?
Sure. So Bradley had a pretty handy victory in this race. It was not as close as I think that that some folks, especially on the liberal side of the spectrum, hoped and predicted. There were multiple factors that led to this, but I mean a big one is there was this exciting, very contested Republican presidential primary going on, and there was a lot of turnout on the conservative side. Rebecca Bradley is a conservative justice. Also, though, there were a lot of Democratic primary voters who did not vote in down ballot races. So there were a number of from the Democratic side of the aisle look like missing votes for Joanne Kloppenburg. And Kloppenburg, I think, especially struggled to get votes in Milwaukee, in Milwaukee County, which is an area where a candidate on the left side of the spectrum needs to get a lot of votes to counteract some of the more conservative rest of the state.
You mentioned the turnout there, and yeah, it was record-breaking. Do you have a sense of why Wisconsin turned out the way it did to vote on Tuesday?
Come on! How could you not vote? You got to vote. It was so exciting, right? And because both on the Republican and Democratic side are alive and contested, and interesting races. I think that there was a lot of incentive to get people out. And I mean, it was what do they say? It's the highest turnout since 1972. That's pretty good.
Right. And that wasn't the only thing going on. The turnout. This was also the first trial run of Wisconsin's new voter ID law. Do you have a sense about how that played out at the polls?
To some extent, we're waiting for some data. Governor Scott Walker and Republicans are claiming victory for voter ID. Walker tweeted that the biggest turnout shows that the voter ID works. It was easy to vote, hard to cheat. But of course, it wasn't really easy to vote for everyone. We had, we had a reporter in Stevens Point who talked to students who were in a line that took them more than 2 hours to register. And there were long waiting lines throughout the state, even in Rib Mountain, sort of in Wausau's backyard here where I am. It's not a densely populated area. It's not an urban area, and there aren't a lot of 18-year-old first-time voters, and there still was a wait of over an hour. So it's I think that folks on the sort of on the left side of the spectrum or just opponents of voter ID say that policy was driving a lot of these long waiting times, and that ultimately that does have the effect of discouraging people from participating.
And Rob, just briefly before we move on, I caught an article that you read about the winners and losers in this year's primary. And, you know, you started off saying, you know, kind of the circus has left town, the national spotlight that has moved on. But they did leave us with a gift, the phrase Wisconsin nice.
Yeah. Have you ever heard this phrase before about the last,
no.
last week?
Minnesota nice, yes, but not Minnesota so much Wisconsin nice.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm with you. It was this is like probably the weirdest part of a weird election cycle was all of a sudden the New York Times and the Washington Post and everywhere else were writing about this, putting in quotes this phrase Wisconsin nice as if that was an actual phrase that had an actual meaning.
It does now.
It does now, and I think the meaning is nice. I think we're nice people. Well, that's nice.
It's literal, maybe redundant.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking with Robert Menser right now, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Talking with him to check out the biggest news stories this week. And another story that you're tracking, a number of media organizations are suing the State Department of Justice. What's happening there?
Yes. So I work for one of these news organizations. So I should say right away that I have no part in this lawsuit. I'm not a spokesman for these companies, and I only know what I read in the newspaper. But we did cover this story, and it really is interesting. This grew out of a case against a couple of brothers in Eagle River who are charged with securities fraud for a company. They owned a bunch of rental properties, and according to state prosecutors, they were lying to their investors and saying that they had these big cash reserves and that their business was going great, when in fact they were losing $18 million in 2007, $28 million in 2008, and they had $63 million in debt. So this is sort of, as the housing market was crashing. So, okay, so this is the charge against these brothers. They're charged with misleading their investors. Charges are filed, and then the defense attorney for the Eliason brothers comes out with a press release attacking the prosecutor's decision to bring charges and arguing basically that they didn't break any laws. He's the defense attorney. You would expect him to make an argument in their defense. In response to that, on March 4th, the state filed a request to a judge to issue a sweeping gag order to prohibit them and their attorneys from talking to the press or the public about the court proceedings. They said in their filing that they wanted to avoid tainting the jury pool. So USA Today Network Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Wisconsin State Journal, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, a whole bunch, others too, filed a lawsuit saying that this was an attempt to muzzle free speech rights, basically. So it's an interesting case on its own right, and it also raises the question of what are people allowed to say in public?
And what is the next step in that one?
So the Justice Department this week, just on Thursday, filed another. They filed a response, a brief, and they claim that the gag order that they're requesting is narrowly tailored, and that so there may be room for limiting the scope of that, or I don't know what. At any rate, the next step is that there's a court hearing next week, and we'll see what comes of that.
And lastly, Robert, a historic vote in the city of Ephraim, this is a town in Door County, on whether or not to remain the last dry municipality in the state. What happened?
That's right. Yeah, good news. This is the biggest election news of the week, right? The good people of Ephraim won't have to go all the way to Sister Bay to buy their beer anymore. This is the last municipality that didn't allow alcohol in Wisconsin has been dry since the day it was founded in 1853. But the voters, by a huge margin of 127
wow.
to 98 votes, total votes, approved a referendum that will allow them to sell, like a convenience store to sell beer. And then there was a second referendum that could even allow the establishment of a tavern.
So that's a big change in Ephraim. That used to be how you knew Ephraim. You would say that's the dry one.
That's right.
It was beautiful, beautiful place as well, but that was what made it stand out in Door County.
That's right. And there was I saw a sign from the campaign that said, vote no on Proposition 2, save Ephraim. Save Ephraim. So I guess that's something has certainly changed.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Now, storytelling editor Robert Menser recapping the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says the deck is stacked against night owls in our society. She's got advice on how those night owls can cope.
First, the U.S. House of Representatives heads back into session next week, and Wisconsin's delegation will be back in the nation's capital. Last week, we checked in with Democratic Congressman Ron Kind, and now Republican Glenn Grothman is with us for a look at his priorities and his thoughts on news from the campaign trail.
Glenn Grothman represents Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District, which stretches from eastern Wisconsin to the central part of the state. Representative Grothman, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Glad to be on the show. We're flying between Princeton and Rosendale as we speak. So
Rosendale, don't drive too fast.
Everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. That's exactly right. We got to be on the lookout for the cops.
Well, as you head back to Congress next week, what are some of your top priorities in the House?
Well, our number one priority will be the budget, of course. We're working on the budget right now. The budget has not been done yet. There's a disagreement on the total amount spent, but we want to wrap up that budget. Then Paul Ryan has established some committees, one of which is dealing with welfare and opportunity. I'll be very active there. We're going to look at the disincentives we have in our society right now, both to work and to get married. That's something I look forward to dealing with. I've been touring various low-income housing projects in my district to see what's going good and what's going not good.
Is there something that you think Congress could do on the low-income housing issue that might help?
Well, I think for younger people, low-income housing, the elderly and disabled, the program seems to work just fine. But for the younger people, I think when I talk to a lot of the people who run the projects, they think a work requirement would be good. It's a very generous thing. Some of these low-income housing projects, there's paying nothing for rent, paying $50 for rent for what may be a 2 or 3 bedroom unit. Well, that's just not right. And I think I've gotten a lot of feedback saying that maybe we should put a 3 or 5 year requirement on this thing and tell people to get to work.
I know you've met with constituents in your district during this congressional recess. What kind of issues are you hearing from them? What's important in your district?
Good overall concern about the economy, as well as concern that we get a good president. I think a lot of people, you know, they don't know about the people who are out there right now. So there's a lot of general concern that America is not what it once was. Partly they're concerned about the welfare, what they perceive to be not that good of a work ethic among some younger people. But I think the major thing is they just want to see the economy take off more good jobs, get back to the days where, you know, somebody could work hard and support a family.
Well, you mentioned that presidential race. Of course, we just had our primary here, and I was hoping to hear your reaction to that, the big race between Senator Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, Governor John Kasich didn't really get any delegates here. What did you think about how that all came out on Tuesday?
Well, I think we can see the public on both sides is not satisfied with the establishment. I mean, you have Hillary Clinton on the Democrat side. You couldn't have somebody more establishment, you know, somebody who's been around forever, kind of been part of the, I'd say, foreign policy failures of the Obama administration, the ethical lapses she'd had and the ethical lapses of her husband. You know, so some guy who's over 70 years old comes out of the blue and beats her. I mean, that's a shock. On the Republican side, you have Ted Cruz, probably the most anti-establishment senator up there. You have Donald Trump. I think a lot of people don't know what he stands for, but whatever he stands for, he sure comes across as not being establishment. People are tired of stuff as usual, which is kind of what I ran on 2 years ago. They're tired of politicians, you know, spending like drunken sailors. They are tired of a welfare state that's roping in more and more young people living the welfare lifestyle. Businessmen are tired of the excessive amount of regulation. More cost for the bankers, more cost for the manufacturers, more cost for the insurance companies. They're saying, hey, we need something different. I hope that the Republicans wake up in Washington now and do begin to pass more bills, changing our tax system, changing the welfare system, showing more respect for our Constitution. But I do think the Wisconsin primary should have sent a message, as many of the other primaries did, to the politicians in Washington. Hey, come on, let's go.
your party may be headed, if you look at the math, to a contested convention. There's talk of, you know, does Trump come in first place but lose out to Ted Cruz, or do they both lose out to your delegation colleague, Paul Ryan? What would you think if it came out that way?
Well, Paul would be a good president. I think the important thing that if it winds up going not to Cruz and Trump, and I still think Ted Cruz might be able to get the votes, but it doesn't go to either one. The voters have sent a clear message. Okay, Paul would be good, but a clear message, not an establishment as always candidate, not a Jeb Bush sort of candidate. And I think number one, the thing that sunk so many of the establishment candidates so far is they're bad on immigration. You know, we need immigrants in this country. We need immigrants for many businesses. I enjoy talking to immigrants. But the last few administrations, be it the Bush, be it the Obama, or be it the Clinton, have not really been entirely serious about enforcing our immigration laws. In other words, they've said that new generation of Americans, the one thing we want is we want people, the first thing they do in this country is to break the law coming in. Well, the Republican primary voter does not want that. They like immigrants, but they're saying we want to pick the immigrants, not the people breaking the law. So whoever they pick, if it's not Cruz or Trump, they had better pick someone who's got a history of saying we've got to enforce our immigration laws.
Talking to Wisconsin Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman, getting ready to head back to business at the U.S. House next week. And you've been in the news for some comments on election night. WTMJ-TV asked you about Republicans' chances in the presidential race here in Wisconsin. And here's your answer. We'll give a listen. It got a lot of attention.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up. And now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well.
There's the second part that got a lot of attention there. People are asking, and I'll ask you now, how would voter ID help Republicans win the presidential race here in Wisconsin?
Well, some Republicans wonder, and, you know, we haven't any convictions, or at least not widespread convictions, but you sometimes wonder if there's some irregularities in the voting. The whole purpose of photo ID is to make sure the person who votes is the person who they say they are. And we like to believe that the cleaner the election, the more confident we are that a Republican will win. So that's what I mean about that comment. You know, that's the reason we passed the bill. You know, there were concerns out there. I don't know why the Democrats fight that photo ID so much. I mean, you know, in other areas of life, you know, I get on an airplane, I got to show a photo ID. Some medicines, I have to show a photo ID. Depending on where I am in a bank, I'm going to have to show a photo ID when I cash a check to make sure who I am there. I don't know why the Democrats don't get more excited and say, oh, we're discriminating against the poor. They can't get on an airplane. We're discriminating against the poor. They can't buy certain medicines. We wonder why the Democrats are so opposed to knowing that the person who votes is really the person who they say they are. But it just confirms in my mind that it was a good law that we have. And one thing we found out about this week with a record turnout, no serious person can say that photo ID is making it difficult for people to vote, or you wouldn't have that record turnout, record number of people voting in an April election.
A former staffer for Republican State Senator Dale Schultz this week, mainly because of the use of the voter ID law this week, said, hey, I was at a meeting with Republican senators when they were crafting this thing, saying they were, he used the word giddy about the opportunity to, he said, suppress turnout among Democratic voting groups. Is that how you remember it from when this was being crafted?
Well, I don't know whether I'm the type of person who ever gets giddy about anything. I guess I think it was a good bill. I think there are a lot of Republicans who wonder if some fraud's going on out there, and they were happy to have the bill passed.
Well, I wanted to ask, you've moved, of course, from the state legislature to the federal legislature, and I've heard you've seen a big difference there. At the state level, Senate and Assembly members interact a lot, and you've seen very little interaction between members of the U.S. Senate and the House. Can you talk about that and how you think it affects the way we run the country?
Well, I think it's good when the senators in Madison, I thought it was good that the senators and assemblymen knew each other. There was sometimes a little friction between the Senate and the Assembly, but they knew each other. They saw each other in the rotunda. At the end of the evening, you'd go out together, knew each other. In Washington, the Senate is on the north side of the building. The congressmen are on the south side of the building. At the end of the day, the congressmen go further south to their offices. The senators go further north to their offices. There's not as much interaction. I think that's a bad thing. I mean, if you want to get something done, it's got to pass both houses. It's easier to pass both houses if you know the senators and the senators know the congressmen. It's just one thing that I think we ought to be looking at. I think one thing that the Republicans have done is they have a retreat each year now in January, in which at least the senators and congressmen are invited to get together. But I wish they would do that sort of thing more.
And
I could spend an entire week in Washington and never see a senator. And that's not really right.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Representative Grothman, thanks for joining us.
Well, as always, I'm glad to talk to erudite listeners of public radio.
That was Glenn Grothman, congressional representative from Wisconsin's 6th District.
Coming up, we'll find out what it can be like being a night owl and what can feel like a world geared toward early birds. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, with President Obama's Supreme Court nomination in limbo, Ken talks about President Nixon's ill-fated Supreme Court nominations in 1969 and 1970, both rejected by the Senate. That's tonight at 7.
First, night owls tend to get the short end of the stick in today's world. People who stay up late can be seen as lazy and undisciplined, and we've even got sayings spelling out the superior virtue of early risers, like the early bird gets the worm.
But some night owls say they're tired of facing societal discrimination and point out that new science shows our bodies might be hardwired to want to sleep late. We've got an article about that up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Carolyn Scher joins us now. She's a sleep success coach, speaker, author, and proud night owl. Her career in sleep started with her efforts to help other night owls live in an early bird world. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you got involved advocating for night owls quite a few years ago. Has anything changed since then? Are we living in a world that's maybe more friendly to night owls?
I don't know. I think there is more awareness maybe that we do have night owls and early birds, but I don't know that overall things have changed in terms of making things easier for night owls. I'm sad to say that because when I first started writing and talking about this subject and advocating for night owls, that was 20 years ago. So it takes a long time, but the fact that you're doing shows like this and that you're making reference to an article on the subject and all of that kind of thing means that there's some awareness that's starting to become available.
Can you give us a sense of how things are stacked against that person who is a night owl? They're just wired to go to bed late, get up late. What kind of challenges do they face in the schedule of the world they live in?
Oh, it's quite significant. I mean, I am prime example of that. There are, you know, all kinds of issues that come up with primarily meeting schedules in the morning. So whether you're going to school, and that was the case for me, going to classes early in the morning, and early means, you know, for me, 8:30 means early. But people who are going to work at, 7:30, 8 o'clock, which are a common start times to the day. It's very hard to be awake at that time. And even if you are forced to be awake, because we have these things called alarm clocks, that you're still really not, physically and mentally alert enough to be able to really be productive. So that is challenging. I mean, that's the primary challenge is, you know, these early morning schedules. But the other challenge, and that article that you referenced, you know, makes reference to this as well, is it's often the emotional toll that it takes because of the kinds of sayings that you talked about earlier. And that idea that, in my case, I felt very guilty about not being able to be normal. Why couldn't I get up when everyone else got up? And so lots of people feel that somehow that they're less than because they're not able to fit into this early bird schedule. And that by itself just takes an emotional toll.
What do we know about the science, what science has to say about whether we are really just sort of pre-programmed to be early birds or night owls?
Yeah, the science on this is fairly well established. Being a night owl or early bird, and there is a third type, which is called intermediate types, but this is a continuum with early birds at one end and intermediates and night owls at the other end. So this is a continuum of a characteristic that's called circadian type. And so that circadian type is all really just about the functioning of, or the cycling rather, of body temperature and how that dictates when you have a physiological predisposition. And that's what we're talking about here, circadian type, and here come some big words. Circadian type is about genetically predetermined physiological characteristics. And so, you know, that's the same thing as if somebody has red hair, that's a genetically predetermined physiological characteristic. And circadian type is as well. So instead of having blonde, black, and red hair, we have night owls, early birds, and intermediates.
Talking to Carolyn Scher, she's a sleep success coach, and we're talking about the challenges of being a night owl. Now, somebody who's wired, really, in a lot of ways to go to bed late, get up later than the rest of us, but they're in a world set to an early bird schedule for the most part. And Carolyn, I want to talk about teenagers a little bit. We hear a lot about kids and teens and sleep and sometimes the clash between sleep schedule and the school schedule. Do you see this as a particularly big problem for teenagers?
Oh, absolutely. This is a huge problem. Talk to any teacher. In fact, I was doing a presentation for a class 16, 17-year-olds in a high school, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and half of them literally were sleeping on their desks. Now, I know sometimes I'm not the most engaging speaker, but I was thinking, you know, if this was a math class or this was a science class, you absolutely would want all of those students to be alert and attentive and able to learn. So, again, there is fairly well-established research now that shows that these students are not learning well, that with start times, and in the United States, start times in high schools are, you know, 7:30 in the morning sometimes. And so there's been quite an effort in the United States particularly to try to get the start times to at least 8:30. I know I'm familiar with a couple of high schools where I live in Canada, and their start times are usually no earlier than 8:30, but some of them have now moved to 9 o'clock start times, and they have found that there are tremendous differences in students just being more awake and more alert. So, yeah, school start times are a very big issue.
And as you say, that is a movement that seems like it's picking up some momentum, seems like it's largely data-driven, and that's influencing it. Do you see any sort of corollary for just regular work schedules maybe being more flexible for people maybe on the horizon?
Well, they're absolutely, again, in terms of workplace management, there is very much more an interest or a drive to have more flexible work schedules. But unfortunately, that flexibility is being driven by other workplace concerns like, you know, increased staffing or increased workload or offering benefits to employees in terms of being able to work from home and those kinds of things. So that flexibility in the workplace has not yet gone to, you know, looking at circadian type and how flexibility is so valuable for that. As a byproduct of flexibility in the workplace, then night owls are, you know, particularly those that have the flexibility to work at home, are benefiting from it. But that's not the primary reason for flexibility. I would certainly like to have, you know, people and employers consider it more, but it's not happening yet.
So that means there are going to be a lot of people who are night owls by nature, and they're stuck with an early school schedule or an early work schedule. Do you have some advice on how they can make the best of it, how they can do what they can to adjust their sleep schedule so they're reasonably alert and productive?
Well, it's pretty hard for night owls to adjust their sleep schedules in any way. I mean, and that's the case for early birds as well, that because this is a physiological characteristic that's operating with a set of physiology in your body, it's pretty hard to change. There are some things that are possible, but, you know, the advice we frequently give to night owls is, well, you should just go to bed earlier. And you have to understand that we can force ourselves to wake at a certain time, but it is very difficult to force ourselves to sleep at a time when our body is not ready for sleep. So that kind of advice to night owl types is really not useful. One of the first things that I say in terms of how do you manage this for night owls is to actually recognize that this is a physiological trait that's being manifested. It's not about you being lazy. It's not about you being a loser. It's not about you being a less than perfect person and all of that kind of thing. I mean, I've been there. I know all those feelings. So just recognizing that, you know, no one gives you a hard time because of the color of your hair, and so no one should be giving you a hard time about this. So that acceptance of this is your body, this is how you were made. And I also say ditch the guilt. Guilt serves no purpose here, so when you have an awareness that your body is working the way it's supposed to be working, then ditch the guilt. A lot of, I say, ask for accommodation in your workplace, and I've heard both sides of this argument when people say, well, our organization is too small to allow for that flexibility, or our organization is too big. And you know, in both those situations, I think you have more options than you think that you do, and especially if you ask for the accommodation, not as the employer doing something for you, but you can frame it as a benefit to your employer.
And we're talking with Carolyn Schur right now about what it's like to be a night owl in an early rising world. She is a proud night owl herself, also a sleep expert and an author.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a night owl? How do you navigate maybe an early scheduled job? Does your boss understand if he has to come in late? Do you think that night owls just don't get a fair shake? The deck is stacked against them in our society. And what questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking about what it can be like to be a night owl in a world that feels geared toward the early bird. Talking with a proud night owl herself and sleep expert and author, Carolyn Schur.
And we want to hear from you. Is this you? Is this your story? Are you a night owl in an early bird world? How do you navigate that? How does it affect you? What would change? What could help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Jackie on the line in Madison. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, good morning. Afternoon. I can relate to this story. When I was in my 20s, I worked a graveyard shift. And I always thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice if there was some club, for example, that might be open for folks that were working the same schedule that I did. For example, my folks, other friends that would work 9 to 5, usually you'd, you know, maybe go out to the club and party at around 9 or 10. And I wish that there were a club that I could go to at noon or 2 in the afternoon, and there'd be other people that are in the same schedule as me, you know, and have some drinks and dance and party at that time. So I always thought there'd be a market for something like that.
Yeah, interesting point, Jackie. Thanks for that. Carolyn, I don't know, that seems like something there would be potential for if you look at the 24-hour global marketplace, which is always open somewhere. What do you think?
Yeah, and that is the case that we do have services available much more on a 24-hour basis. So, for instance, if you're coming off shift and you need to get groceries, you know, whether that's 7 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock at night or it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, there's usually a grocery store open. You know, and perhaps not a bar or entertainment at 7 o'clock in the morning, but increasingly that's becoming the case. I do want to say something actually about this particular comment about doing night shift. Shift workers are, you know, an entirely different group from night owls, but as much as we talk about the disadvantages of being a night owl in our early bird world, we are increasingly becoming a 24-hour world with activities on all the time. And this need for doing night shift is becoming more and more common. And it just so happens that night owls, in spite of struggling with getting to work in the early morning, are actually quite well adapted to being night shift workers. And so that's an advantage that night owls do have, that if you are struggling with, you know, getting to work at an early time, maybe you do need to consider a job which is more conducive to the type of schedule that you have. And doing work in the evening or doing a night shift is that kind of work.
Thanks for that call, Jackie. Scott on Facebook writes, the only thing discriminating against late risers, he says, is the real world. The sun rises early. Stop validating the lazy, Scott writes. So I assume you've heard this argument before, Carolyn. What do you say to that?
Oh, I just want to scream when I hear that. I'm sorry. No, I mean, Scott really needs to understand, and it's the kind of thing that I hear from people who really don't understand how the body works. And yes, we are influenced by sunlight and the daylight. That is true. But there also is this physiology that happens in the body, and there's a number of facets associated with that. So we won't get into that. But this is a physiology that happens with the body. And that's why we exhibit this sleep-wake behavior. It has nothing to do with laziness.
And that's where we'll leave it. Carolyn, thanks for joining us. That was Carolyn Schur, a sleep success coach, speaker, author, and night owl, talking about night owls in an early bird world. It's been nearly a year since Republicans leading the state legislature cut $250 million from the UW system budget. As the cuts trickled down to the state's 26 campuses, they looked for ways to deal with the shortfall. At UW-Eau Claire, one solution was to offer incentives for early retirement. As Rich Kramer reports, the program has worked and the university is projected to save money eventually, but many are left wondering if the savings are worth the costs.
Last spring, UW-Eau Claire Chancellor Jim Schmidt got word that his campus would be hit by a 16% reduction in state aid, the third largest cut of all UW schools. When combined with the deficit from the previous campus budget and a decline in enrollment, the home of the Blue Golds faced a shortfall of more than $12 million. To free up some money, Schmidt announced he would offer incentives for older faculty and staff to retire early.
The voluntary separation program was formed after a program we'd used successfully in Minnesota, and Eau Claire was the first one to develop and implement that program. About half of the UW schools ended up doing that.
There were 98 faculty and staff who took early retirement at UW-Eau Claire. Among them were Terry and Liz Shemelsky, who taught communications on campus for more than 36 years. When the incentive program went public, Liz says they began to talk about retiring.
We didn't react emotionally we really sat down, the two of us, and thought, what is best for our life? Where some people were just angry. And it seems like recently everyone who's been leaving UWEC is leaving in anger or frustration or disappointment, whether they're leaving for another job or they're retiring.
Despite that anger, there was a sense early retirement was a way to avoid mass layoffs. Jeff Peterson chairs UW-Eau Claire's political science department. He says it was the best choice in a bad situation.
I know people on campus who took retirement early because they wanted to make sure that, you know, newly hired faculty didn't get fired. I mean, they explicitly said, you know, I could keep going, I'm fine, I can keep teaching, but if my retiring saves somebody else's job, then I'm more than willing to do it.
Officials say UW-Eau Claire saved more than $5 million on the buyouts, which was less than half of the university's total shortfall. To cover the rest, administration laid off some employees and left unfilled positions open. Buyouts included, 179 full-time positions were lost, which works out to 15% of the entire workforce. Student Senate President Jake Rassi says that has hurt instruction. He says there are 197 fewer course offerings this year, and class sizes are growing.
Because of this, all over the institution, students are noticing, even if it's slight in some cases, that their one-on-one experiences with the professor become more difficult when you have many, many more students in a single section of a class.
But not all students say they've noticed the changes. Erin O'Brien is a sophomore and leader of the UW-Eau Claire College Republicans. She says she hasn't been impacted and believes the university can weather the storm.
Unfortunately, that does come with a loss of employees and administration and faculty, which is devastating, and that is something that I hate to see happen. But when it comes to something like a deficit within the state budget, you have to take cuts where they're necessary.
Chancellor Schmidt says UW-Eau Claire's budget is balanced through this year thanks to spending down the last of its tuition reserves and additional cuts to things like facilities and administration. He's hoping for more funding or at least more flexibility in the next state budget. Schmidt says another round of cuts like this would fundamentally cripple the UW system and its campuses. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll get the details on a new report that tracked the water quality in Wisconsin prisons.
Monday is Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday. We'll look back at her books and talk about your favorite children's literature.
And we'll check in with the latest in cool science with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak. We talk to Gemma every month, and this month she's going to be talking about disease fingerprinting and also taking a look at low-tech climate change solutions.
And we'll hear about a dispute over what is plus size when it comes to women and women's clothing, a big hullabaloo in a magazine. That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Coming up Monday at 7:30, Joy and her guests look at the results from school referenda on Tuesday's election, with a lot of districts getting increased funding approved by voters. That's Monday morning here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll hear about some breaking news. A judge has, at least for now, overturned Wisconsin's right-to-work legislation. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.